I hereby introduce to you Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, 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 welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. Today's show is brought to you by Amazing FBA's mentoring program. So I'm kind of sponsoring my own show. I just wanted to briefly tell you about the mentoring program because it's about to go away at its current price point and in its current form. The mentoring program is there very simply to get you launched, like pretty much everything I do for the more, you know, early days sellers, apart from the 10K Collective, which is obviously for people doing very, very well and ambitious to scale. Everything else I do is really geared to helping you get launched with your first private label product within probably 6 months, maybe 9 months if you're really busy and have other projects on the go. So if you want to work with me for £300 a month for two 90-minute sessions plus email support, that is the current offer. I'm going to take one more person on, maximum two, if the other candidate is really, really special and looks like a really great person is going to succeed. Either that or by the end of June, one of those, whichever comes first. Then after that, I'm going to yank the mentoring program at that price point. And when it goes back up, it's going to be part of a bigger, more powerful package, including an online course, which I'm very excited about. And it's going to be at least £500 a month, probably more, because I'm putting a higher value on my time because I realize opportunity cost is a real cost. And hopefully you realize that as well. So if you value your time, there are three things you need to have to even apply for mentoring. You need at least £5,000 in inventory money. That's not to cover your training costs with me. That's additional, but just for inventory, 20 hours a week to devote to building a business, and 6 months of your time to devote to it as well. Otherwise, I think you're just wasting your time and I won't take you on because I don't want to take your money for the sake of it. I want to take your money only in exchange for great value and you creating your business, finally getting off the ground. So amazingfba.com/mentoring if that interests you. Otherwise, on with the show. Thanks for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. I'm delighted to have with me a real sage of e-commerce and much bigger than that, I think, in terms of online marketing and thinking, but very practical, applicable thinking. And that man is Jason Miles of Winning on Shopify. So if you want to have access to the increasing number of episodes I'm recording with Jason, and we'll be doing more because there is so much good stuff to get from this man, it's untrue, then get yourself over to amazingfba.com/JasonMJAS for sugar, O-N-M, and you'll find that all there. So Jason, welcome back to the show. We are talking about digital goods and it sounds incredibly exciting. We talked about this in a sort of big picture, which I think is important sometimes to change our thinking around. Let's get more into the nitty gritty. We're starting to get into how to sell courses and we're talking about moving the free line and Udemy and various things like that. Can you expand on some of those things for us?
Yeah, happy to. We were talking about the idea of, you know, the challenge of maintaining good pricing and good margins on your digital goods. And I think that what you have to realize is a lot of this stuff is niche driven topically. And you want to really think through what topics you want to operate in. And so the question is in your niche. Like, so if you just say, okay, what are the niches that I am thinking about? Then the question is, how big is the competition? Who are you up against? How good are they? How much money do they have? And how do you rate? And it's a real, real stupid idea to drag your let's say baseball bat into the stadium for the Los Angeles Dodgers and think that you're going to step up to the plate and take a few swings. First of all, it's not, so you get the metaphor, like you've got to think through, am I in the right niche against the right people? Now, what's really interesting is how big the universe of online selling is at this point. And it's only getting bigger. And so what I always tell people is you want to find a niche that is so laughably small that literally when you tell people, they're like, what? Well, I don't get it. Like, and they laugh kind of. They're like, that's what you do? Because if you say, well, I sell, pick some big topic, then you're selling against massive competitors. So you got to find a niche that's defensible that, you can really drill into. And what's fascinating is there's a book that is the best book on this topic I could recommend to anybody. It's Chris Anderson. It's called The Long Tail. you got to reread it and just think through, okay, you know, this book was so sage and it was so early that I think a lot of people have now forgotten how, you know, the kind of that it was out there. But if you go through this book, it has principle after principle about digital goods and long tail concepts that directly apply. So for here's one little example. In our business, we sell doll clothes patterns as digital PDF files. And as I mentioned, in May, we did over 75,000 transactions through our site. There are two giant categories just related to mine that I don't sell in, that I want to sell in, that are super popular, super on trend, and I can almost guarantee you've never heard of them, but in our niche, they are, there's a huge volume of demand. And just as if you care or whatever, somebody listening, amigurumi is one, and then cloth doll art dolls are the other. So how to make a cloth doll, that's a conceptually understandable. Amigurumi is a Japanese crochet technique where you make cute little animals out of knit and crochet. So anyway, but these are massive categories. And most of the people who aren't familiar with that niche or industry have never even, they don't even know what I'm talking about. You know what I mean? Like do you even know what I'm talking about now?
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I mean, I was about to say amigurumi. I'm like, is this a kind of hip 60s saying? Amigurumi, man. But I was thinking, you know, this is probably Japanese, right? So yeah, absolutely. I mean,
way down the niches.
Way down the tail, right?
Yeah. Way down the tail.
Yeah.
Is the idea. And every seller can start to think through that and look for demand. And the long tail book, I would highly encourage everybody to read.
I remember reading that about the year it came out. Was it 2007? I mean, it's been around for a while now. It's never been, that was such a prescient book because it basically predicted how massive Amazon and Apple and iTunes and things like that were going to become when they were somewhat big, but not really mainstream big. I mean, now that Jeff Bezos is the world's richest person in history, then you kind of can't avoid knowing about Amazon.
Yeah.
His
book chronicles the ideas associated with this industry, and they're still there. And his second book, his follow-up book, is called Free: The Future of a Radical Price. Ooh. And that's the book that really gets into pricing power and how to stay price worthy.
Yeah.
Which in digital goods, which is obviously an important piece. So,
well, let's talk more about that. I mean, before we get into that, though, I want to reflect just to echo a couple of the things again from the sort of with that Amazon head on, if you like, which I still definitely have. The idea of picking a winnable market it is possible, by the way, to pick a market that is so niche that nobody's buying anything on it. In Amazon, for example, or it might not appear on Google. That doesn't mean nobody's doing it, period, online. But if it's very hard for people to find, you've got to make sure you at least know where those people are. So there's a little bit of a caveat there. But that said, a lot of the time people get very excited by the turnover in an Amazon market, or for that matter, online, or for that matter, in the universe. It kind of doesn't matter because it's one of those classic things. I don't know if you've ever seen Dragon's Den, and my favorite person in Dragon's Den is Mr. Wonderful Kevin,
of course,
very grumpy guy, and it kind of reminds me of me on a bad day when I'm coaching.
Which is, of course, the Shark Tank team. They just brought it to the US as Shark Tank, so it was Canadian originally.
Absolutely Canadian, just up the road from you, I guess, in a way. Well, probably not, given the size of the country, but so anyway, they would always be devastatingly rude if somebody said something like in their pitch, well, I'm going to sell coffee. You know what? There are 66 million people in the UK, and they drink an average of 5 cups a day. So that's a 200 million a day coffee cups market. And then he would just look at them and say, yeah, what the hell makes you think you're going to take any piece of that? And this is the point, right? Can you take a piece of the market? Not is it valuable per se? Is it winnable?
Exactly.
And people just bypass that quite often, even now, even when you would imagine that they would have heard enough podcasts saying that. Somehow people see the dollar signs and they go, wow, somebody's making $1 million a month selling random widgets. And I'm like, yeah, but they got $1 million a month to spend on marketing, my friend. How much money have you got? $5,000. So I just want to plead with anyone who's thinking of doing that in any market, but specifically in Amazon, because I spend a lot of time working with people like that, please look at the numbers and think rationally about, can I afford to get into this market?
Well, there's two pieces there. Yeah, two pieces there that are really interesting. One piece is, it is Amazon the be-all and end-all in what's actually happening online? In fact, it's not. My category, as I mentioned, doesn't even exist on Amazon. You don't even know that my category exists if all you look at is what sells on Amazon.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, it's a real category. Sewing is a real category. And but the other piece that's interesting, so you can't just get trapped into looking only at Amazon and thinking it's a placeholder for everything else, like as if to say everything off Amazon is just a copy of what's on Amazon. That is not true. So then the other piece is the long tail concept versus what Silicon Valley thinking asks you to do, which is total addressable market. You know, TAM is the acronym they use for that. And then, so that's the bellwether idea for a lot of Silicon Valley startups is, what's the total addressable market and can we make any traction against them? And that's what, you know, Mr. Wonderful will laugh at sometimes, you know, I mean, so this is the trick, is finding a long tail idea, a niche that you is defensible. And the reason it's important to do that is because, let's say I choose a big topic. I'm going up against killers. I'm going up against Mr. Wonderful, right? Why would I want to compete against Mr. Wonderful in any category, in any topic? I wouldn't.
Yeah.
So I want to go where Mr. Wonderful will not go. And generally speaking, that means a much, much, much smaller total addressable market and a niche that is sort of laughably small, as you know, as I mentioned before. So that's the idea of looking at a niche versus a large category in society. Yeah.
Absolutely. And coming back to Amazon again, and then although this is to do with digital goods, but I mean, one of the trends that's so blindingly obvious, especially in the USA, is that if you go into a large, you know, total addressable market, some widgets category that is not particularly brand driven. So if you're looking at training shoes, I mean, Nike had that thought. So if you're really wanting to compete in there, you better make damn sure you're not competing on the same turf as Nike, and you're not going to try and go for the same price point. But then if the Chinese factories, who have literally entire cities devoted to manufacturing a single type of product, there's Toilet City famously, all they make is toilets and baths. That is it. Yeah. If you want to sell some kind of bath fitting that is fairly unstructured, not branded, not very interesting, not designed, not getting any brand around it, and you just want to do that purely and simply, you are up against the might of China, which makes Kevin, whatever his name is, Mr. Wonderful, look like a pygmy. Yeah. Yeah. So this is another thing that is even more important to not do that on Amazon.
Right.
So let's talk about, so we've talked about, I think people are convinced about the idea of a niche. How do we find a niche then? How do we identify one?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. So, you know, there are a few ideas that you want to think through. First of all, a lot of this niche work comes out of familiarity with categories because of deep interest, hobbies, you know, your passion for something. I mean, just in the conversations I've had with you, I know you have a passion for music. So, I mean, part of the discovery process, as I mentioned before, is if you just look on Amazon and use research tools, you won't find this stuff necessarily. So you've got to go beyond that. And then you've got to put your ear to the railroad tracks and say, okay, you know, what is out there that I'm not, you know, understanding? Start to talk to industry insiders, start to do research on types of products that serve specific customers. And you want to start to look for a few bellwether signs. You want to have raving fans or customers for a specific niche or topic. People who come back over and over and over to buy repeatedly. And so, you know, think of, I mean, for me, I always have a few different examples I can pick on, but fishing is an example. Think of fishing, right? That's sort of universal in many ways, but it's a pretty niche-y thing. And so then what are fishermen regularly buying, right? And so now a lot of times you'd think that's physical items, but could it be digital? Right. And is there an opportunity for the crossover between what used to be physical item, but now could be delivered digitally, that kind of thing. So that's, you know, so you start to think through these categories like, you know, of consumer interest. And then what you want to do is take even a deeper cut and say, well, what is there that's not being, you know, offered or delivered, or what is coming that's, you know, going to be on trend in the next few years? There's a timeliness to this stuff. Once you find your niche topic, you can be real late to creating content or digital goods. So topically, you have to be on trend. And you don't know that unless you get stuck in. So if specific fishing, you know, niche stuff is of interest, then it's like, well, what's trendy? What's not trendy? What was popular 10 years ago? You got to learn this stuff. And you got to start to think, okay, what's going to be coming down the tracks? And how can I position myself for that? And this happens in big business topics as well. I got my first book deal with McGraw-Hill called Pinterest Power, and did well with that book. I got that book because I simply started blogging about marketing on Pinterest, and the acquisition editors for the big publishers in New York were looking for authors that could write about marketing on Pinterest. Well, as it happened, the universe was real small in 2010, 2011, and my blog content rose to the top. I got a book deal. But so there's a timeliness to this stuff. So here's one piece I want to mention too. Once you drill in and start to discover a niche, hopefully that's answered a few of the ways you can do it. The other piece is quality versus quantity, and the ideas of, you know, hits versus not hits, and how do you actually make money through this stuff. So have we covered how to find a niche well enough, or do you want me to keep going on that one?
Well, I think there's certainly a lot of interesting ideas, but I do think it's a very, very important question. I mean, I know for a fact from working with lots and lots of would-be Amazon sellers, and I say would-be because they never become Amazon sellers in many cases, yeah, because they get stuck on what the hell should I sell? Research. And I think it's partly because they're asking the wrong question. I'm always saying to people, look, stop looking for physical products in the first instance and look for the person in the pain, or the person, or what Andre Schupper on the email marketer would call the pocket of people. But it's the same idea. It's basically a who, not a what question. And I think that's the first thing. I love the idea that familiarity with categories because of a deep interest. I'm always begging people to find one. Some people don't seem to have any deep interest. And I always find there's very, very difficult clients to work with because I have a theory
mm-hmm. about this. And I totally agree with everything you just said. It's exactly right. That is the mindset, is that you find the people. But mm-hmm. as it relates to people's passion, I've run into, because I've worked with over 15,000 students now on the Shopify training stuff. And I hear this issue come up, and I'll work with people on brainstorming ideas, but then I'll start to ask them, well, what's your industry background? What have you done for the last 10, 15, 20 years?
Yeah.
And they'll tell me. And then they'll tell me they don't want to have anything to do with that industry. Or they'll tell me reasons why they can't do something in that industry. And I always say to them, that's ridiculous. That's literally like, that's like taking your, you know, your 10,000 hours that you spent in an industry that you know the most about and literally saying, screw that. I don't care about that topic. I'm going to go figure out how to sell, you know, plumbing fixtures, even though you've never been a plumber, you know, and that's so ridiculous. This is the wrong mentality. You know, so that's one piece of it. The other piece of it though, I honestly think that sometimes when coaches or gurus or people like us are working with people and we say, what are you super passionate about? I think they have things that they're passionate about that they're not willing to tell us. And they might actually be super into, I mean, look around my office behind me. You see an old Tonka truck that was, you know, that has my logo on it. I have Betafish over in the corner. I have little slot cars that I bought at a garage sale. I have topics that I'm passionate about and interested in that are sort of quasi weird, quasi embarrassing. Like, how many people are into slot cars where you know, you set up a track and you have these little cars that run? Well, I am, and probably millions of other guys that grew up in the 70s in the United States. And so, you know, you have to think through, those are the types of topics you want to start to drill into. I've seriously thought about doing a Betafish e-commerce business repeatedly because I love it. They're so cool and interesting to me. So
what these are the fish? I don't even know that.
Oh, Japanese fighting fish.
Oh wow, you know, I've heard
really,
of
really colorful Japanese fighting fish.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but see, these are the thing. And most people who are on the hunt for an Amazon product will say, "Well, that's what." That's too small, or that's just my hobby. I don't think I could make money off of that. But see, that's exactly where you should go to, you know?
It's funny that when you say that, I get this certain kind of, you know, for example, I'm not interested in fighting fish, no offense, but I am, I get that kind of, you know, that kind of feeling in the fingers are like, wow, this feels like a niche. This feels like something people are going to be weirdly passionate about.
Right.
We should dig into this. And yeah. They always get that feeling. And before, when I get that, you shouldn't prejudge a market, but I think I like to always start with that feeling as let's dig deep into this. Let's not give up on this too quickly. And then let's dig around online and see if other people share, you know, Jason's passion. You might discover it's just Jason and three people in Seattle and Washington, right. And that is it, you know. Yeah. Yeah. But it's unlikely in this world.
Right.
Because just coming back to the long tail thing, one of the words that stuck in my head, and I haven't read it since 2007, and you mentioned it twice now, I really should go reread that along with other billion books, but aggregate is the word. And an aggregator means that you put together all the, you know, three people in this town and 10 people here and 50 people in New York City and 100 people in London or whatever that happen to be into Japanese fighting fish. They all gather on one website or, you know, whether that's Amazon or, you know, Jason's new JapaneseFightingFish.com or whatever it becomes.
Yep.
And suddenly out of these tens and fifties, you get 5,000 people, 10,000 people. And that becomes a market you can make a living from, right?
Well, there's two sides to each market, the sellers and the buyers. Now, this will blow your mind up. This is a fantastic topic. There's two sides to every market, the buyer and the seller. So you can aggregate both sides. So, for example, if you go to Pixie Fair right now, that's my website, what you'll discover is that my wife's brand, Liberty Jane, was our – we think of that site like a shopping mall where we are the anchor store. And there are other sellers. So we have about 100 other designers that sell with us. So we've aggregated the sellers. And that's allowed us to have a catalog of about 2,400 digitally downloaded items. So that's the aggregation that's interesting as well, is on the seller side. And then aggregation on the buyer side is what you just mentioned, which he talks about in Long Tail, which is if there's one butterfly aficionado in your small town of 10,000 people, you can't sell, you can't have a butterfly store. But if you have one of those people in every town across America and everywhere in the world, you've got a massive marketplace opportunity online. And that's the idea of aggregation on the buyer side. Yeah.
Interesting. So actually another way, this is very, very relevant actually for Amazon sellers to think this through. It's always interesting talking with you because I never quite know where it's going to go, but it's always... It's always incredibly important, I think, as an insight, because it affects how you act. I mean, this is the acid test of, is an insight valuable for me? And aggregation on the seller side is what Amazon's done. They've created a marketplace like you guys did. You created your own marketplace. Yeah. But yeah. Amazon has aggregated a bunch of sellers as well as a bunch of buyers. But one of the issues we have as the sellers is they've aggregated a lot of sellers into a very visible format. In other words, there are 16 listings or whatever it is, 14 on a mobile, whatever it is, of buyers for any given keyword out there that you can put in, really. Yeah. So what do we need to do about that?
The question is, can you envision a future in which Amazon is grows so large that it's fractured? I mean, can you envision an online future in which Amazon is not what Amazon is today, where basically the categories have grown so large that other competitors come up? I mean, so for example, the only reason I am interested in Amazon at all is if they buy my website, if they own me. And if you go to things like Zappos or Fabric.com or 1-800-Diapers or Diapers.com, those are all websites that Amazon's purchased, but they're not. They didn't close them. They didn't shut them down. You know, and so that's important to think through. Is there will be a future in which effective, focused niche websites are immune to Amazon's influence because the focus in the niche is so tight for such a good audience that, you know, because at some point it's almost like walking into, you know, like, I don't know about you, but when I walk into a bookstore, I only go to the business section. Well, if there was a bookstore that was just business books, I would walk into that bookstore every 2 days. So, but online, I mean, these are the questions of sorting and focus. And Amazon has gotten to a point of massive scale that's almost, I mean, think of it like the first department store in the world, which I believe was like JCPenney's, as it grew out of a catalog business. Well, that didn't last. And I'm not saying there's going to be a demise of Amazon anytime soon, but I am saying that what Amazon has created is basically so huge, so massive, that it creates reasons why people might consider not being on it. I mean, as you just described, the race to the bottom on the product seller side, that's incentive for anyone who wants to be stuck into a category to say, can I survive off Amazon? I mean, it's a really interesting question to think through. And where will all this be in 5 years or 10 years? So, I mean, it's something to think through if you're really passionate about a certain topic.
It certainly is. I mean, I think the seductive power of Amazon for both the sellers and the buyers actually is kind of this aggregation of both, I guess, that we've talked about, isn't it? That they've got so many buyers there, that sellers want to be there, and there are so many sellers there of so many different things, including Amazon as the lead brand and with huge, you know, in-house selection, just massive, still half of the revenue that they generate on the retail platform. Yeah, that's hugely attractive to buyers. So I guess that's the upside.
The question for the seller is, what would be the reason you would consider taking your own whack at a category off of Amazon, and how could you do it? Aggregating sellers for a niche or industry and banding together to do your own site with your own collection of 10, 20 sellers for a specific topic. I mean, that's big box retailing strategy versus, you know, sort of the specialty store strategy is the offline equivalent to that. Big boxes have won, but there are small stores that do really, really well. Ulta Cosmetics, for example, is crushing it in the United States. All they sell is cosmetics in a retail store. And, you know, they compete with Macy's, you know, cosmetics counter. Well, at Macy's, you're distracted by a million other things. When you walk into Ulta, all you see is cosmetics. These are so that's an offline equivalent. The online equivalents, I think, are out there as well, which in the future, I think, will become more and more obvious. So,
wow. This has gone very deep as usual. Let's just go back to some, perhaps for people who are just considering plunging from physical products into digital products. Let's get back to some more basic things. Let's talk about pricing, because there's a theme behind a lot of this stuff, which is that you were saying, you know, as you quoted at the end of the last episode, that Stuart, who was it now? The information
brand.
Will be free. Stuart Brand, that's it. So that has a pressure downwards on the price of digital goods. Then there's a downwards pressure on the price of physical goods on Amazon because of the aggregation of all those sellers from China, particularly because they have a lot of capital, they have a lot of production capacity. Amazon has a big sort of comparison site. All of that pushes down on the prices all across the board. How do we defend our price?
I think the biggest question that you have to ask yourself is, what's the competition for the information? Now, you know, if you've got a secret recipe that a million people want, and you're the only person with the secret recipe, you set the price. But that, as soon as the second person has a secret recipe or some equivalent recipe, then you've got a price war. Mm. So then, so demand for information is one thing. And so that's the first piece to think through, is what is the demand for the information? I'm never a proponent of being a race to the bottom participant. But if you're going to be in a race to the, here's a traditional example of this related to pricing. Encyclopedia Britannica used to be sold door to door, and people would have them on their shelves. If you were middle class or upper class, you'd have a set of encyclopedias. If you're lower middle class, you couldn't afford them, so you go to the library, like 100 years ago or whatever. So that was a $600 million a year business in its heyday. And then what came along? Well, Encarta was launched by Microsoft, a CD-ROM drive that had encyclopedia information on it. That line of business was a $100 million business for Microsoft at its heyday. So it cut the total value of it drastically. Well, what came along after Encarta? Well, Wikipedia. Wikipedia has basically the lowest price possible, which is free. The only thing lower than that is if I actually give you money to consume my content, which is hard to pull off. But you get the idea. So then the question is, well, okay, in the race at the bottom on that one, the winner is the one that has the free item. So the question is, can you have the free item and survive? Obviously, Wikipedia is putting out all the time on the top of its site, please give us donations. It's trying to operate on basically a charitable basis, right? So then the question in your category is, can you give away free information? and monetize in a different way. You're doing that right now through this podcast. You already described that, right?
Yeah.
So give away the content for free, monetize in a different way. And that's tried and true. That goes back to Free, the Future of a Radical Price, the other book by Chris Anderson. And he gives, I think, 20 models of pricing strategy related to how to monetize free, which, I mean, that list by itself, and I apologize, I don't have it in front of me. I was looking for the book on my shelf behind me. I couldn't find it just before we jumped on. But that list of, I think it's 20 ways to monetize free products is genius in that book and worth looking at. But you've got to ask your question yourself, can it be defensible? Now, the best way to make it defensible, just to cut right to the chase, is to create a brand that people trust and that they know, like and respect and believe in. Once you position yourself as a trusted deliverer of product that's, you know, information, then you've got a position that you can defend. Can you get that trust with an audience? And can you deliver a product that wows people? If you can do that and you can lower the price to make it free and do cross subsidies where you have other ways you get paid, then you, by all means, do that. If you go to Pixie Fair, as our classical example, every Friday I give away a free, one of our products for free as a digital download. You can get it for free. It's normally $3.99 to $8.99, and on Friday it's free. Well, every Friday I have 10 to 13,000 of those downloaded. And so, but I monetize in other ways, right? So, I mean, these are the ideas you want to think through. You want to create a catalog business, typically, where you've got a lot of things that you can offer people. And you want to have high quality, although in a catalog business, people want and are willing to take items of all different qualities. And that's important to think through. It doesn't always have to be perfectly well made or put together, especially if it's a hot topic or a new thing or something that, you know, no one else is putting out there. If you're the only deliverer of how to do something and it's just a crappy looking Word document that you didn't format well at all, but you saved it as a PDF and it looks like garbage, but it's the only thing on the internet that delivers how to do something, people won't care.
Right. Yeah, I think that comes down to a book from another very, very good business book, which is, again, quite dense and by a grown-up business person, not just a marketer who's got one idea that they're spinning, which is the idea of the minimum viable product. And exactly. The key is to really hear all three words. People often hear minimum product and that or minimal product, and that's not really the point. A minimal viable is exactly like you just described, and it depends on the other alternatives, to use the word, rather than competition from the blue ocean strategy. Right. What else could I do? If I'm a person who wants to, you know, set up my tank of Japanese fighting fish and I have no idea how to do it, and Jason's the only person who gives a nice, clear set of instructions with, you know, several videos and some helpful links to Amazon to sell some equipment, and that's the only one on the line, it doesn't really matter if your photos are a bit ugly. It's right. Formatted like, you know, by a blind person, and you know, the videos look like they were shot in the dark on an iPhone, because that gives them the information. They have no other choices, right? And I think people get very confused about that. I think often on Amazon, the minimum viable product in a lot of categories is pretty good. It has to be well branded, it has to be well photographed, whatever, and people get the idea that minimal is good. No, that's not the same.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. You know, and some of the content that you can do digitally, you can do minimal in an interesting way. I mean, like, for example, Udemy courses. You know, some Udemy courses are 13 hours of instruction. But then I've seen some courses that say the 1 hour guide to Excel spreadsheets. You know, well, they're delivering their promise of the length of the course right in the title, and people buy it, you know. So you don't have to always necessarily be the biggest deliverer of content or the best deliverer. You can creatively position these things.
Yeah. This is a very good point. And you're talking to a man who's just in the middle of creating a course that's probably going to weigh in at over 200 videos by the time we finish.
Yeah, today. Right.
Yeah, I need to hear that. I need to hear that. So tell us a little bit more. We've talked to you. You've got a little bit of time to just tell us as a sort of wrap up, begin to bring this one home, because it's such a huge topic. And
yeah.
Very thought-provoking. So we've talked about basically how to find a niche market, which I do think is so, so important that everyone gets obsessed with how to do marketing and before they even have any idea of how to find a decent market. But having found a niche and decided you're passionate about it, there are other people who are passionate about it, the competition is manageable, it's defensible, you know, and if you can get the great product out there because you really understand it and care about it, and you believe there's business to be had here, what's the next stage with marketing that?
Yeah, obviously most people's mind immediately goes to the thing they fear the most or don't understand the most, and that's traffic generation, right? So how do you get traffic? And you know, there's tried and true strategies for that. I mean, obviously that's multiple podcasts that we could go into. But I will just, you know, I'll say that there are a couple elements to it that I think are interesting to me. One element is the idea of influencers, and influencers have, in essence, in the last 2, 3, 4 years, mainly because of Instagram and YouTube, influencer marketing has become a thing. And for my book coming out, Instagram Power, I just talking to a guy who he manages 2 Instagram accounts for his dogs. One dog has each, you know, each one has an account. Now this is the interesting part. As soon as they got to 50,000 followers, the day they got to 50,000, because it happened on separate days, he started getting, he said, like 8 to 10 influencer offers a day.
Wow.
Where influencers, and he's the influencer, and these are product sellers, marketers, saying, hey, would you give a shout out to doggytreats.com or whatever, like dog chow food company or whatever it is. And so so the influencer marketing world right now is fascinating. So let's just go back to our example. Let's say that you're passionate about the Japanese fighting fish, which of course I don't fight, by the way. I just have them.
I wondered vaguely.
No, I don't fight them.
In the water, yeah.
No. Let's not fight our Japanese fighting fish. They're called beta fish, by the way. Anyway, so okay. let's just say that I wanted to actually have a product that was physical or digital or a combo, right? One of the smartest things I could do is go find the influencers that are already out there, that already have the proven YouTube channel, the proven, you know, Instagram account, the proven Facebook group, and talk to them about the idea of affiliate marketing, cross promoting, some type of paid placement. You get the idea. Just having a conversation with them and allowing the influencers in any space to weave you into their universe. That's one of the best on-ramps. And you know, those deals like on Instagram, those deals are frequently, hey, I'll send you a bag of my product if you'll give me a shout out. I'm like, okay, all right, I'm happy to give your audience a free copy of my ebook if you'll give a shout out. Okay, here it is. So, you know, these are not complicated deals necessarily, especially on the low end of it. So that's one piece. The other piece I would just constantly encourage people to try out is contests. Contests are tried and true. People love winning stuff. It's so fun. Interruption marketing, basically like advertising. And nobody likes that. Like nobody wants to be interrupted when you're browsing cat videos online. Like you don't want to be distracted by some marketer, right? But that's what ads do. They're interruption marketing. Well, contests are the opposite of that. Contests shared virally are fun, interesting. They give you something, kind of unique to offer to your prospects. You give away a prize that they like, and they hear about it from their friends, and it goes viral through these forums, groups, online communities, because once they all start entering, they all start hearing about it from each other. And so contests are a huge way to generate traffic. So those two strategies by themselves, influencers and contests, there's a whole universe of opportunity there in each one of those for people who are trying to figure out how to get traffic.
Excellent. And I just draw people's attention to, if you go to amazingfba.com/JasonM for mother, or for Miles, of course, in this case, that we, in our one of our other interviews we did in the past, you've talked about the 9 different sort of traffic strategies related to contests. So I'm not going to rehash that here. But folks, really, really, if you're worrying about traffic, and who doesn't, as you said, Jason, I mean, why would you not? But I mean, that is particularly if you're on Shopify or in your own universe away from Amazon, once you're away from the what seems like the mothership, but was actually the prison ship, depending on how you look at it. you know, yes, you've got to deal with it. It's both. But you got to deal with this reality. And actually, it's not as scary as you think, because I haven't tried contests yet, but influencers, I mean, I suppose in a way, I am one of those in a minor sort of way, probably. But people do constantly approach me. And what you probably don't get if you're trying to sell a product or even a service is, take it from me, I get a gap in my schedule and I think, what the hell am I going to put out next week? I've either got to sit down there and produce some content myself, or leave a gap and get punished by iTunes or have angry subscribers who aren't getting new podcast material that they want, if they care about it at all. Or I can get a guest on in some form or other, whether it's a guest blog or mostly a guest interview like this. And that's fantastic for me, because it keeps the wheels spinning. It keeps people like YouTube and iTunes happy. And it keeps my customers connected to me and know, liking, and trusting, as you said, those three things, the Holy Trinity.
Yep.
So take it from me as an influencer. We're hungry for this. We need good content. Yes, we don't want every Tom, Dick, and Harry who comes out of the blue with something that's rather sketchy looking. But if they seem legit, this is a hunger that we all have as influencers. So I would encourage you to be really courageous at approaching influencers. And I'm not surprised that some of them will say, yeah, just do it for a bag of my product. I have people on who cannot, for example, I have a lawyer who comes on sometimes, CJ Rosenbaum. He cannot give me an affiliate deal because it's not legal for him to do that. But I get him on. Why? Because it's valuable content for my listeners and watchers. And the thing is, that's so important, because I know the value of that relationship that I have with people who are listening, watching, reading. And I can't emphasize enough how, from the inside, how important, how open a goal this is for many people.
Yeah.
I'm not big. If I were huge, if I got more than a certain number of downloads of the podcast, I imagine I would start getting pitched. And then that's the point at which actually it's hard to make contact.
And let me just make one final point on that, if I can. A lot of us look back with regret on the opportunities we've missed. We say, for example, man, when you could do Google ads and no one else was doing Google ads and you could get a click for 5 cents, it was the heyday and I missed that and I didn't understand at the time what was available to me. And then, social media comes along and it's like, hey, now, social media advertising works so great. Facebook ads work so great at first. But we look at with regret. But right now, the current opportunity is influencer marketing deals. Yeah. It is. And what's amazing about this is that, like, look, let's say you're into your niche or topic and you're just getting into it. You meet those influencers this year and this month and you do some deals with them, and you could be working with those people for the next 10 years. It's not like you need a lot of them. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. They're passionate about their thing and you're going to be selling in that space. So it's not as if, this is a fleeting opportunity. You get your influencer strategy worked on this year, it could be paying off, ringing the, dinner bell for you for, years to come.
Excellent. So, ringing the dinner bell. I love that. The last thing I would say as well, just to bring it home to the Amazon space, for those who are feeling a bit freaked out about the fact that we're talking about not only off Amazon, but digital stuff as well.
Yeah.
This influencer marketing as part of the puzzle 100% works for people who are just purely selling digital product, physical products on Amazon, because I've been working with some people in the 10K Collective, they're such a bunch of action takers and they have so much initiative. They're a joy to work with. But some of those guys have been doing really well. Somebody's had an Instagram influencer they work with, and they've had some hits and some misses, but one of them, they just killed it with just some, we've had somebody got something on the Jonathan Ross Show, which is a TV channel which has several million people, and that ripped through a load of his products. But this was another example of somebody who's just been on Love Island, but was not one of the major winners, but sort of a minor celebrity of the moment. And they're selling, I can't even remember the product, and they just put one post up on Instagram and it moved hundreds of units. I mean, it really was that effective, and it didn't cost them a lot of money. I don't honestly remember. I can go and dig around, and because people should be demanding the number, but it was of the order of a few $100 or something like that. I mean,
and we're hearing stories like this time after time after time, and it's a wide open opportunity. These people have created huge followings on Instagram or YouTube. They're looking for ways to make money with it. You're coming along with information or physical products, and they're more than happy to entertain the conversation with you. And it's big. It's really big.
Here. Well, it's fantastic to end on a very actionable point. I think anyone, doesn't matter whether you're selling on Amazon or on Shopify, whether it's digital goods, whether it's physical goods, you got somebody out there who doesn't know the value of what they got. That's an opportunity. And basically somebody who's got 50,000 followers on one of these main social media channels was just like me. They were starting something up. They wanted to get recognition. They felt passionate. They wanted to share. They enjoy the process. They don't necessarily even have a business-like brain about it. I mean, at least I started with the idea that I might monetize it. A lot of people don't even have that. So yeah, can't emphasize enough. So great to leave it on such a positive and actionable note. Jason, as ever, incredibly thought-provoking. We've got loads and loads of notes. I was promising myself not to do that. So folks, if you hear the tapping in the background of me typing, forgive me, but it will mean that the show notes are that much better. As ever, they are at amazingfba.com/JasonM. In this case, in the name, first name of the guest and then the last name initial. So Jason, a couple of wrap-up questions. First of all, where can people find out more from you if they want to learn more of this good stuff?
Yeah, winningonshopify.com is where I blog and we do our video content, that kind of thing. We have trainings on all kinds of different topics, or doing a social contests, take action group actually this next month. So we're always doing stuff like that, winningonshopify.com. And then hit me up on, you know, Instagram. I'm hanging out on Instagram these days, and on Facebook. Those two spots, you can find us and go from there as well. So,
fantastic. So, Jason, just remains for me to say many, many thanks for such a thought-provoking and also very actionable stuff. It's amazing.
Man. Yeah, it's an honor.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Now, over to you. First, 80-20 everything. Learn the critical few. Maybe there's one thing in this podcast that can make all the difference. Find that thing. 20% of inputs, give 80% of the outputs. Which are the critical few for you? Then take action. Imperfect action beats perfect inaction every single time. Finally, and not least, review. If you've made mistakes, learn from them. If you've made a success, duplicate it. You can't do that unless you look back. So in summary, learn the critical few. Then do, then review. And then, my friend, it's up to you. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Speak to you in the next episode.